I would now like to turn the conference over to Drew Altman. Please go ahead, sir.
Thanks, operator. Hi, everyone. We are in California, Chicago, and Washington, D.C., so good morning and good afternoon, depending on where you are. This is amazingly our 17th employer health benefit survey. This year, we have a very moderate premium increase, but an important trend about increasing deductibles to talk about, which I think could be an emerging issue in healthcare, along with drug costs, which are obviously in focus right at the moment, and other consumer issues, as well as findings on the Cadillac tax, how employers are responding to the employer mandate, wellness benefits, and more to talk about. I'm personally very happy to be back with our partners at HRET and for a summary of this to be published in Health Affairs, as it is every year. You're going to hear from Matthew Ray, who is our lead analyst on the survey, and from Gary Claxton, who you all know has led the project every year since the beginning of time. I will be back in just a minute with some very brief framing comments. First, let's hear from Malik Joshi, who's the president of HRET, our longtime partner on this project. Malik, go ahead.
Great. Thank you very much, Drew, and welcome to everyone. Again, as Drew said, we are just absolutely delighted to be able to partner with the Kaiser Family Foundation on this in its 17th year. It really is quite amazing. This is a terrific resource for us as a nation, especially knowing all the changes that are happening in healthcare today and for the foreseeable future. We hope this provides a really incredible resource that way. Again, thanks to Drew, Gary, Matthew, the entire Kaiser Family Foundation team. Just exceptional work. We appreciate their thought, leadership, and support in doing this. I'm going to turn it back over to Drew quickly, but I just want to highlight one set of data points that I think will provide a little bit of interesting information as we get into some of the main messages. Drew already framed a little bit around the moderate premium increase, some of the changes around deductibles and other areas that I know Gary and Matthew will get into more. One of the other things to talk a little bit about just for a minute or so is on the health and wellness that we're seeing offered by large firms at very high rates. We know from the survey that 50% of large firms offer or require their employees to complete a health risk assessment, a really important piece around health and wellness. 56% of large firms use incentives or penalties to encourage their employees to complete biometric screening, an important in-person health exam that helps you to measure things such as cholesterol or blood pressure by a professional. 81% of large firms offer their employees at least one health behavior program, such as stop smoking, losing weight, or other lifestyle behavioral changes. Of the large firms, again, that offer health benefits and wellness, 38% offer employees a financial incentive to participate in or complete the wellness program. When you look at just these as a quick snapshot, I think it's all very positive news, especially as we speak to health as a priority in addition to health care in our community. Just a little bit of what's happening, and again, I'm going to turn it back over to Drew and the team to get into the more framing of the big messages. Again, positive notes already around some of the high level of offering and participation around health and wellness. Thank you again to the Kaiser Family Foundation for their support and everybody being on this. Drew, back to you.
Thank you, Malik. I'm actually glad you started with that because that's a really important change in the landscape of employer health benefits, and I want to make sure those findings don't get lost today. Actually, great. All right, just a couple of introductory comments from me, very brief. I want to get to the findings. The 4% increase we're reporting for 2015, it continues a remarkable 10 year run of moderate increases in premiums and health costs. Generally, we can talk about that, but it's also a health cost slowdown, which has been, I would say, all but invisible to consumers, in large part because deductibles, other forms of cost sharing, have been going up so much faster than their wages or premiums in recent years, almost 7 times faster than wages and almost 3 times faster than premiums over the last 5 years. It's a very, very striking finding, and that's why we featured it in the press release. And I think that explains why in our separate August Kaiser tracking poll, people named deductibles as their top health cost problem. There could be a further spurt in deductibles if the Cadillac tax goes into effect. You know, it may or may not. It may be modified. It may be repealed, or it may go into effect just as intended. We don't know. But if it goes into effect, because raising deductibles is certainly one response employers will make to the tax. You will also see in the survey that despite all the debate about the so-called employer mandate or employer requirements, as the requirement is poised to go for from employers with 100 to 50 workers, the actual employer response does not match the rhetoric of the debate. It's muted, it's modest, it cuts in different directions with no big shift to part-time employment. Overall, having watched employer responses to healthcare costs for a very long time, with the moderation we're seeing in premium increases, you won't see employers doing anything dramatic on health benefits. We didn't see that in the past when costs were rising by double digits, and there's even less reason to expect that we will see it now. On the other hand, with deductibles growing so much faster than wages, as the ACA fades a little bit as an issue after the King decision, I think many politicians will be looking for a less partisan post-ACA agenda that will resonate with the public in health, and deductibles and drug costs and other pocketbook consumer issues could emerge as the next big health issue, not instead of the ACA, but alongside the ACA. So we'll have a more multifaceted health policy agenda. And I discussed this in my think tank column in the Wall Street Journal, which should be live just about now. So with that brief introduction, let me turn it over to Matthew and Gary. We're going to start with Matthew. We'll go through the key findings, and then, of course, we'll take your questions. So, Matthew.
Thank you, Drew. This is Matthew Ray. I'm a senior health policy analyst, and I work on the survey. So as Drew alluded to, the big finding this year was the increase in the 4% increase in both single and family coverage premiums. The average family coverage premium is now $17,500, with workers contributing almost $5,000 towards family coverage premiums on average. Next slide. As Drew said, this continues sort of a period of modest growth. We've seen average annual growth rates of 5% for the last 10 years. This is lower than the growth rates we saw in the early 2000s. And I think Gary has some thoughts to add on where premiums may be going at the end of the presentation. Even a smaller rate of growth can have meaningful impacts on workers and employers alike. Since we've done this survey 17 years ago, family health insurance premiums and worker contributions have both increased about 200%. Workers' earnings and inflation have grown about a quarter as fast. In 2015, workers' earnings increased 1.9%. And overall inflation remained flat. Next slide. There continues to be meaningful differences in average premiums and worker contributions at different types of firms. This chart focuses on firm size, with the dark blue, the worker contribution, and the total bar height as the premium. As we've seen in the past, small and large firms have different approaches to the worker contribution towards the premium. On average, workers at small firms contribute less for single coverage, but more for family coverage. Next. There are also differences by the wage level at the firm. On average, workers at firms with many lower wage workers contribute more for family health insurance, but are covered by a less expensive policy than covered workers at firms with fewer lower wage workers. Employers contribute less for both single coverage and family coverage, on average, for covered workers at firms with many lower wage workers. In addition to making a contribution to the premium, most workers face additional cost sharing when they access services. As Drew was speaking about, one of the big findings this year is around deductibles. The percent of covered workers enrolled in a plan with a general annual deductible has increased over time from 55% in 2006 to 81% in 2015. In addition to more workers facing a deductible, the average deductible workers do face has increased. In 2015, the average annual deductible for covered workers who have a deductible is $1,318, more than $900 5 years ago. Looking at all covered workers, those who have a deductible and those who don't, the average deductible is now $1,077 compared to $646 5 years ago. Over the last 5 years, the growth in the average deductible for all workers has gone up 67%, far outpacing the growth in premiums and workers' earnings more generally. Premiums and family premiums have increased 24% over the same period. Following from these trends around deductibles, the percent of covered workers enrolled in a plan with a high deductible has increased over time. What we used to think of as a high deductible has become commonplace amongst employers. In 2015, 63% of covered workers at small firms and 39% of covered workers at large firms faced a deductible of $1,000 or more. I'm going to turn it over to Gary to carry on the findings.
Good morning, all. It's Gary Claxton. I'm Vice President here. We're first looking at enrollment. In 2015, 52% of covered workers are enrolled in a PPO plan, which is a decrease from last year. 24% are enrolled in a high deductible health plan with some sort of savings option, either a health reimbursement arrangement or a health savings account qualified plan. 14% are enrolled in an HMO, 10% in a point of service plan, and 1% in a conventional plan. Importantly, every year we look at the offer rate, what percent of firms are offering health benefits to their employees. 50% of firms offer health benefits to at least some of their employees in 2015, which is similar to the percentage over the last few years. Almost all large firms offer coverage. 97% of firms with 100 or more workers offer coverage. Over the long term, though, the percent of firms offering coverage has fallen from the rates we have seen in the early 2000s, and you can sort of see the downward general slope there. Next slide. 63% of workers in firms that offer health benefits are covered by the benefits offered by their own firm. That also is similar to previous years. This slide also shows eligibility and take-up rates, which also are similar to previous years. But also similar to what we saw with the offer rate, the coverage rate has fallen over the long term from the rates we saw in the early 2000s. So in both cases, we're seeing a trend towards modestly less offer and less coverage at your own firm, and the two are interrelated. Next slide. Over the last few years, benefit consultants, brokers, insurers, and others have developed private exchanges where employers can offer their employees a choice of health plans. Some analysts and people in the employee benefit world see this approach as a way to put a defined contribution arrangement in place. With a defined contribution, employers contribute a set amount towards health benefits, which an employee can apply towards whatever health plan they choose, often with a sort of large number of plans to choose from. While this approach has gotten a lot of attention in the literature, we still see a very small percentage of covered workers get their benefits through a private exchange in 2015, and a very small percent of firms are offering benefits through a private exchange. 17% of employers do say they are considering using a private exchange in the future, and 26% are considering a defined benefit approach. As was mentioned earlier, we do collect a lot of information on wellness programs because they're such an important part of what is going on in employee benefits these days. For this year, we actually changed the questions and the way we approach it to try and focus in on some key pieces and get more details about certain aspects of it. The good part is we have more information. The bad part is that some of the you really can't have trends from our prior data to this year because we did ask the questions differently. As you can see from this slide, about half of all firms offering health benefits say they ask or require their employees to complete a health risk assessment. 31% of large firms have a financial incentive for employees to complete the health risk assessment. Similarly, with biometric screening, about half of large firms ask employees to complete a biometric screen, and 28% of large firms have financial incentives to complete the screening. There's a lot of information in the survey about the screening, including the types of information that's asked for, like blood cholesterol and body mass index and such. 81% of large firms offer at least one of the listed wellness programs that are listed across the bottom of the slide. and 31% of large firms have an incentive tied to participating or completing the program. Next slide. As you can see from this slide, large firms are more likely than small firms to have these types of wellness programs. Next slide. There are lots of incentives for participating and completing in various programs and parts of the wellness approaches that employers take, including incentives, as we've shown, related to the health risk assessment and biometric screening, and also incentives related to the particular wellness programs. And it's hard to sum that all up. One way we tried to do that was we asked firms who do have incentives for participating or completing a wellness program what the maximum annual value of the incentive could be, and we asked them to include any incentives that relate to that for completing health risk assessments or biometric screening. I'm trying to get sort of a, like one number that employees might be subject to under the wellness program. For most workers, the maximum incentive is less than $500. For 16%, it's greater than $1,000. Another issue that's been has gotten a lot of discussion, in part because of what's going on in the in exchanges in the individual market, are the networks that employers use for their health benefits and that insurers use for their health benefits. So we ask a few questions about that. 17% of small firms and 24% of large firms say they have a tiered or high-performance network for their largest health plan. These types of networks offer employees financial incentives to use certain providers in the network who might be either considered lower cost or higher quality. We saw a fairly small share of firms say that they or their insurer eliminated a hospital or a health system from a network to reduce costs, or that they are considering offering a narrow network plan. Another issue that's gotten some amount of attention in the last year or two has been the cost of prescription drugs, and particularly the costs associated with specialty drugs, which might include biologics or other high-cost medications. We ask firms what types of approaches they take to managing these costs. And you can see that there are a variety of them, including step therapy, tight limits on the number of units administered at a single time, utilization management programs, separate cost-sharing tiers. And this slide shows you the percentage of each of those. As Drew mentioned, the employer responsibility provisions took effect this year, and they're extended next year. We asked employers who said they had at least 50 full-time equivalent employees if they had taken certain actions in response to the employer requirements. 2% said they increased waiting periods for new hires. 4% said they reduced the number of full-time employees they intended to hire. 10% said they changed some job classifications from part-time to full-time. And 4% said they changed some job classifications from full-time to part-time. Next slide. We asked firms with 100 or more FTEs about changes that they made to who was offered health benefits in 2015. 21% of employers said they extended eligibility to coverage to people who were not previously eligible. 5% said that they offered more comprehensive benefits to some employees who previously were offered limited benefit plans. And 96% said they offered at least one health benefit plan that met the minimum value and affordability requirements under the ACA. Another provision under the ACA that's getting a lot of attention is the high-cost plan tax, sometimes called the Cadillac tax. We asked firms how they were responding to this. Over half of large firms and a smaller share of small firms said that they had analyzed their plans to see if they would hit the thresholds. Small percentages of firms say that they have already made changes to lower the cost of their plans in response to the tax. Next slide. And of the employers who have taken a response, most of them said that they increased cost sharing, but they've also taken a variety of other approaches, which are listed here, including 34% who said they moved benefit options to account-based plans such as HRA, health reimbursement arrangements, or health savings accounts. Last slide. I think as Drew and Matt mentioned, we've been in a long period of relatively modest premium increases compared to what we had seen previous periods. And there's some question as to how long that will last. The projections in the national health accounts are that healthcare costs are going to increase. And as the economy improves, we would tend to believe that that may be pushing premiums upward. That does seem likely, although with the high-cost plan tax set to take effect in 2018, that might have the sort of push down some of the impetus for costs to go up as employers take actions probably related to cost sharing, but also narrow networks and other things to try and keep premiums lower and avoid the tax. So I think that's all for me.
So that's the grand tour. This is Drew. If you're a glutton for punishment, there's pretty much a fat chapter in a report for every slide that you saw. But that's a quick tour of the findings. And so now, operator, if you would just run people through how they ask their questions, and then we'd be happy to take your questions.
Sure. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to register a question, please press star followed by the one on your telephone keypad. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, please press the pound key. One moment, please, for your first question.
We have a question from the phone, Tammy Luby.
Hey, Tammy.
And Tammy, your line is open.
Hi, thank you so much for doing this. Can you talk a little bit more about how people are not feeling the slowing healthcare costs, particularly about the deductibles? Can you run through the numbers again and just talk about, what's behind this trend? Why are companies raising deductibles? The Cadillac tax is still – this was happening before the Cadillac tax took effect?
Hi, Tammy. It's true. Let me frame it, and then I'll turn it over to Gary and Matthew. I think it's two things. I think it's just to emphasize this. It's deductibles rising a little bit every year, almost $100 a year, a little bit every year, and then that really adds up in combination with flat wages. So if wages were keeping up with the growth in cost sharing, it wouldn't be as big a deal for people. But the pain level is significant. It really affects family budgets because their wages aren't rising at the same time. So it just makes it harder for people to pay the rent or the mortgage or pay for gas to get to work or buy clothes or pay for school. If you're an employer, I am an employer, one of the very few things you can do to reduce your premium increase quickly in any given year is to increase your deductible. So employers, they don't do any one thing. They do a little bit of everything. But one thing they've been doing every year is increasing their deductible, and they've been doing that every year at a time when wages have been flat. So Gary or Matthew, if you want to elaborate on that or just review some of the numbers again.
But I guess just one other point. Yes, wages have been flat, but if healthcare costs are growing so slowly over the past decade, why has there been the need to continue increasing deductibles at a similar pace?
Actually, one reason they've been growing slowly is because deductibles have been increasing. But try and convince a worker of that. Gary, do you want to jump in on this?
That was actually a very good answer. But we also had a time when the economy was poor, and workers are happy to keep their jobs. Those tend to be times employers don't necessarily drop health insurance, but they also, it's an opportunity for them to reduce its level of generosity. And that did happen during the starting in the mid-2000s. And you can particularly see the percent of percent of workers who have a deductible went up. And with the deductible amount also going up, the sort of overall combination is just more people facing these. And that's what we see.
Okay. And I'm sorry, can you just run through, I know the numbers for, I think it's the one-year numbers are in the summary of findings. Can you just run through, did you give 10-year or 5-year numbers?
Are you looking for the percent of people who have a deductible or the average?
No. The difference between the wage increase. You have in the press release, you have since 2010, you talk about the percent increase in deductibles versus wages.
Right.
The longer view on that as well?
We could do the slide back to 2006. We haven't done it.
Okay.
It actually would be much more dramatic because the percent of workers between 2006 and 2010 went up from 56%.
55%.
55%.
To 81%.
Okay.
So, we'd be happy to produce that for you. We'll send it along.
Thank you.
Thanks. Next question.
Next question from the chat, Carl Eisenhower. Did you see a difference in steps taken to avoid the excise tax between firms with unionized workforces and firms with non-unionized workforces?
We didn't do that analysis. It's certainly something we can do or someone can do with the when we release a public use file. But that's not something we did. There are so many statistics here, we don't cross all of them with all of our demographics. But that's certainly something we could look at.
And it's a good question.
We've had a couple questions asking about state-by-state breakdown of the data. Gary, do you want to talk about whether that's possible or not?
Sure, this is a national sample, so we don't have the ability to do state-by-state. We do break down a number of things by region, but that doesn't let you hone in on particular states. There is a comparable survey done in California, which will be released later this year by another foundation, which would provide one point of comparison, but we generally can't do state-level analysis.
Okay. Next question. Kathleen McGorry is interested in hearing the panel speak to what we can expect in the future for premiums and deductibles.
Go ahead, Gary.
Sure. As to premiums, the general projections, you know, from the CMS actuaries and others are that healthcare costs are not going to stay as low as they are going on into the future, in part because of inflation will probably be a little bit higher, but also the pressure of new drugs coming online and just an improving economy, people will demand a little bit more healthcare, would tend to push costs up. And I think we could, although not anywhere near the levels that had been seen in the early 2000s. So I think we can expect some of that to happen. Again, the high-cost plan tax will, to some extent, push back on that as employers try to avoid it because it's a fairly onerous tax, and hitting it is not something they want to do. And then one of the things that the push back from the high-cost plan tax will cause eventually is more cost sharing or other types of ways to try to produce efficiency, but probably cost sharing is part of it. So there's not a lot of reason to think that the trends we've seen on that will moderate too much either. There is a limit to how much you can have in deductibles and keep your workers happy. So as the economy improves, employers will not want to make their health benefits look unattractive, so that's always the thing that kind of pushes towards maybe a little bit higher cost, a little bit better benefits. The high cost plan tax pushes back against that, and we'll see how it all works out.
And a great subject for reporting is obviously cost sharing is an appropriate part, and deductibles are an appropriate part of any insurance package. But the great subject for reporting now as deductibles keep going up is how much is too much and for whom, and in particular, how do high deductibles affect people who use a lot of health care, who are chronically ill, especially people who may be chronically ill and have modest incomes.
Next question from Alex Nixon. Can you talk more about what you expect the response to be from employers to the Cadillac tax?
I think we've been talking around that. Does anyone want to add anything to what we just said? Or?
We do have a slide as to what employers who had already taken some responses have done. We don't have numbers on them. It's like the fourth from the end or third from the end. I think you would expect those types of things. Obviously, overall, the employer community, some of it has come together, interestingly, both large white-collar firms and unions have come together to try to push for changes in the law. We'll see if that comes about. We also issued a report about a week and a half ago about sort of the number of firms that might hit the tax at various points in the future. And one of the points we made there was that there are other health benefits that employees receive, like flexible spending account, the ability to do payroll deduction through FSAs, which might also be affected by firm responses, and that might actually be the first things that are affected. I think you can still find that on our webpage.
All right, next question from Sammy Mack. So there's a drop in eligible workers who sign up for the employer from the employer. So there's a drop in eligible workers who sign up for the employer insurance. Any sense of whether the would-be employer contribution instead goes back into the employee paycheck, or is that a cost saving for most of these employers?
I think what we see is a 1% change in eligibility. That's really not statistically significant, so I don't know that we would say that that's a drop that year. Whether or not the overtime is a trend or not, it certainly looks downward, but I've not tested that over the whole period to see if it is. I think to the extent that the workers do lose eligibility, it may be that it goes into wages. It may not necessarily go into their wages. I think the issues long-term in the employer market have been lower-wage workers just not being able to continue to be offered benefits or to be able to take up their benefits or to be in jobs that are offered benefits. Those workers aren't making very much money. I think that's sort of the long-term issue for the employer market.
Okay. The next question comes from Tammy Smith. Wellness penalties and incentives. They exist for smoking in some places. Do you foresee penalties for failing to lose weight, failing to lower cholesterol and exercise? Also, when workplaces have wellness screenings at the workplace, is there an issue with patient privacy?
As to the first point, we do have in the wellness chapter some information on related to the percent of firms who have in particular incentives related to biometric screening. You can look at that. We're talking about a fairly small percentage of firms at this point, but yes, there are incentives related to the things you mentioned. In terms of privacy, certainly it is an issue that the people who are administering the plan are also the employer, and they are getting all the information that's going into this, and how it's being used is something that is subject to HIPAA requirements. Whether or not those are sufficient, I think people disagree about.
Okay, and once again, I'm going to ask the operator to go over the instructions for questions. And if we don't have any more questions, then we'll do a wrap-up.
Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, to register for an audio question, please press star followed by the number 1.
All right. Good. We have a question from Karen Buford of the Detroit News on the phone.
And Karen, please proceed with your question.
Yes, just to clarify, with regard to cost sharing and deductibles, am I understanding correctly that the deductibles are going up mostly because of decisions that are being made by employers with regard to cost sharing, or is is some of this because of pressure by insurance companies in terms of the cost of the plans? And to what extent, which is which?
Well, this is Gary. I mean, to some extent, those two things go together because the employer and the insurer, unless it's self-funded, then it's just the employer have to make the decision about what level of benefits they offer, and the insurers will give them different prices for different levels of generosity in the plans. It is fairly common for insurers in the small group market to say to employers that your health benefit plan is going to go up by X if you choose to change it, and increasing the deductible is usually the easiest way to change it. You'll only go up by Y, and things like that often happen. But both parties sort of have to be involved when there is an insurer and an employer.
But what do we know about what's happening to the cost of the plans being offered to these employers? I mean, is there a lot of increases in those plans as a result of like new ACA requirements having to do with essential health benefits and so forth? I'm just wondering where the pressure is coming from. Is it mostly coming, from the employer side, or are the employers really faced with a lot of pressure in terms of the cost of insurance going up?
Well, I mean, in terms of covered workers, most covered workers are not subject to the essential health benefits. That's only in the small group market, and that's not most employers. Where they feel the pressure, it could be in parts of the early, in the sort of the mid-2000s, the cost pressure might not have been so much from the health plan per se, but from just general economic conditions, where employers were cutting back in lots of different places, and health benefits might have been one of them. Going forward, the pressure is going to come as the economy improves, probably from higher costs.
Okay, thanks.
And we have another question on the phone from Jerry Geisel of Business Insurance.
So again, in sum, what would you say are the two or three or four key reasons that cost increases have been and continue to be moderate compared to, say, a decade ago?
This is Drew. The slow economic recovery, increases in cost sharing in the healthcare system, and changes in payment and delivery in healthcare, or to say it a little bit more simply, the slow economic recovery and changes in the healthcare system.
Thank you.
Chat question from Sammy Mack. How much does the availability of a wellness program impact the cost of insurance for employers? Anyone? I know that's...
Yeah, I don't think we know that.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think at this point, we're going to wrap up. Does anyone...
No, but thank you, everyone. We're all available, including our colleagues at HRET, for follow-up with all of you individually. And we will see you for number 18. Thank you very much.